The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today is President's Day, time to get a really good deal on a mattress or a new or used car. And of course, a day to celebrate the lives of the nation's leaders. It is their deaths that our colleague Brady Carlson is more interested in. How we mourn and remember them, from grand monuments to street corner statues to namesake sandwiches. In a new book called Dead Presidents, Brady is an exuberant guide to presidential wishes, myths, and monuments, both official and forgotten. And to what dead presidents reveal about ourselves and our history and how we imagine our past and future. Brady Carlson is a reporter and weekend host here at NHPR and author of the new book, Dead Presidents. Brady, so glad you could find the place.
Well, thanks for such detailed directions.
Well, there's so many conventions now, you know, that are expected when a president dies. Of course, it wasn't always that way. George Washington, he wanted a private interment, no parade, no oration. Why were his wishes ignored?
That's one of the big questions in this world of the what I call the post-presidency. George Washington even put it in his will, I don't want a funeral parade, I don't want speeches, I don't want people lining out in the cold to honor me. I just want to be left alone. And the country just couldn't deal with that. At that point, the United States weren't really that united. The regions were going in different directions in a lot of different ways. And so there was a lot of question of how long the states would stay together as one nation. The idea that George Washington was holding it all together through the force of his personality and his personal magnetism as a heroic figure from the Revolution. And the idea of losing that figure, one of the most famous people in the world, was just too much. And so in a way, not to psychoanalyze the people of the late 1700s, but they thought if we keep him here in a sort of phantom form, if we turn him into this civic deity of sorts, this personal example that we can all follow, then we don't really lose him. We hang on to him, and then we can base our unity not on the living George Washington, but on the memory and the legacy of George Washington.
And at first, there was a statue of George Washington in a Grecian toga. Didn't go over all that well. And there were plans for a much grander obelisk than now stands as Washington Monument today. So what happened to that?
Well, the original idea came up before Washington had even died. There were people who wanted to celebrate his contributions to the American Revolution by building an enormous statue of George Washington with horses and all sorts of ornamentation, and they wanted it to be as big as possible. And of course, to make it as big as possible, that meant it had to be as expensive as possible. So they were trying to raise huge amounts of money. What wound up happening was they were having trouble bringing in these large marble bricks through the swampy area around where the monument sits today. In the 1840s or 1850s, they just simply ran out of money and they just stopped building right where they were, which meant there was this stump of a monument right in the middle of Washington, D.C.
Well, not a very distinguished sounding monument, but until it was. But distinction is a big part of these stories. You know, some of them grand deaths, some not so grand, and some, as you make the point, well-timed and not well-timed. So what's an example of a poorly timed death?
Well, probably the most poorly timed death would be our ninth president, William Henry Harrison, who took office on March 4th of 1841, gave a two-hour inaugural address in the cold and snow, and was not wearing a hat or coat at the time. Long story. But he wound up dying a month later, and the conventional wisdom was that he managed to catch a cold during that speech, which turned into pneumonia, which then killed him a month into his presidency. Now, whether that's actually true or not, we don't know, because there's some new research that's been done that suggests the water supply in Washington, D.C. was so bad and the sewer system at the time was so bad that that may have actually killed off President Harrison.
So he didn't die of his inaugural speech?
He may not have, but he was a well-known political figure, a very popular person at the time. And yet today, all he's remembered for is he was president for 30 days.
Well, he could have used a good doctor. So apparently could have James Garfield also did not have such a good run as president. But you found that he probably would have survived his assassination attempt if he'd had a better doctor. So who treated him and how?
Well, the lead doctor in his case was named Dr. Willard Bliss. And Doctor was his actual first name. He was named for the Dr. Willard, who helped his mother when he was being born.
Well, that's a way to skip through medical school.
It's always a good thing to have on your application, I think. The only problem was is that Dr. Bliss did not believe in the germ theory, which was just at that point starting to take hold less in the United States and more in the United Kingdom. And what killed James A. Garfield was not the bullet holes caused by his assassin, but the infections caused by the doctors who were poking their unsterilized hands, ungloved hands, inside the bullet wounds.
This was, of course, like the age of heroic medicine, but also of the Victorian era, this obsession with death. So how did that play out in how Garfield was mourned?
Garfield was shot just a couple of days before Independence Day, and they canceled Independence Day, essentially. There were no parades, there were no fireworks, there were no public displays of celebrating the founding of the nation. Everybody was freaking out. And then when he died, they built him an enormous castle. He actually has a death castle. It is at, you know, something like 100 feet high. And on the outside, there are these reliefs of his life and his death. So there's a relief on the outside of his tomb that shows him laying on his sickbed, starving to death, and being treated horribly for these infections by incompetent doctors.
All right, so this castle is built for him, right? And we have all of these traditions that date back to the Greeks and the Romans. And in the case of the riderless horse, I find out from your book, Genghis Khan. We have the caisson, the catafalque, you know, these European traditions, these august kind of symbols of mourning. And, you know, this is an interesting time because America is trying to distinguish itself from Europe, trying to distinguish itself from the lineage of kings. So what's going on here?
That's an interesting question. There's this dichotomy going on where Americans wanted to, and largely did in many ways, leave their presidents as citizens who happened to be president for a time and then returned to private life after their terms were up. So in the early days of the presidency, there were private funerals, sometimes huge ones in the case of George Washington, but private funerals. They were not run by the government. And they were buried privately on their own ground or in private cemeteries in the places where they lived. That changed in the 1840s, actually with William Henry Harrison's death. He was the first president to die in office. And the people who were in charge of his funeral, essentially his cabinet, realized that American prestige had to be a part of the equation when they were designing his funeral. They wanted to commemorate Harrison in that very American way, as a plain coat-wearing, log cabin-loving kind
of
guy.
Or not coat-wearing in some cases.
And yet they wanted to make sure that as the fallen head of state of a powerful country, that that was acknowledged too. And so they did incorporate things like the riderless horse. They did incorporate a long parade going up through the streets of Washington, D.C. They did have a service in part of the White House and things like that. But once all of that was done, they stuck his body in a vault in Congressional Cemetery in Washington, D.C. for 3 months while they waited for the ground in Ohio to thaw so that they could send him home.
I'm speaking about some of the surprising and largely unknown stories about dead presidents with NHPR's Brady Carlson. He's author of a new book called Dead Presidents. It's an American adventure into the strange deaths and surprising afterlives of our nation's leaders. Okay, so we've learned a lot about some of the presidents, some of the things that weren't so unsavory about them. I'm thinking John Kennedy, Thomas Jefferson, you know, their private conduct, their sexuality. Maybe it's made them more human, but it has certainly changed their sense of legacy. So when does that become part of the thinking of the memorializing? You know, when do the docents at Monticello start talking about Sally Hemings and her descendants?
That's a difficult question, and usually it unfolds over time. Of course, the first rumors about Thomas Jefferson having a relationship with one of the people whom he'd enslaved started back when he was president. There had been rumors in a newspaper that were written off at the time as just anti-Jefferson campaign propaganda. And it would crop up every so often. It came up again during the Civil War or the lead up to the Civil War. And in the Civil Rights Movement, it would come back up again over and over. And it wasn't really until the last couple of decades when there was a DNA study done, and that confirmed that some male Jefferson was part of that line of individuals, that Sally Hemings did in fact have a relationship with some Jefferson. Now, this continues to be controversial among some Jefferson descendants, and there are all kinds of arguments as to which Jefferson it is. There's no way to conclusively say it was Thomas. But the long and the short of it is that the Jefferson family still controls the family burial plot. And if that were to be conclusively proved, then the Jefferson family would have to admit those descendants and allow them room in the burial plot. So far, the Jefferson family has not voted to do that. And so it remains controversial. And it shows you how someone who died in 1826 is still very relevant today, not just because of his presidency, but because of the issue of race and how it continues to resonate and continues to play out in America all these years and decades and centuries later.
Well, how someone is remembered and the legacy they shape for themselves is such an important part, of course, when you're looking about at presidents. I was so struck when you were writing about the funeral of Richard Nixon, who was showered with praise at his funeral in 1994, 20 years after he left the White House in disgrace. I mean, he was being praised from President Clinton, George McGovern, you know, George McGovern, who I think compared him to Hitler at one point. So what is the symbolism there? I mean, is this just that we carry on no matter what?
I think in a lot of ways, people didn't feel like speaking ill of the dead. But I think also at the same time, Richard Nixon himself had worked for those 20 years after he resigned from the presidency to try to bring about a moment so that once he died, people would think differently about his life and his career and his legacy. He wound up working his way back so that he could counsel sitting presidents, and he would write books and he would give speeches. And people were clearly receptive to that, because the reception he got, I think, would have even surprised him. He was spoken of in these glowing terms. And in a way, they were able to find room in the narrative for those failings and for the resignation and the scandals. People in the eulogies talked about how, you know, he would be knocked down, but he would never be knocked out. And he would make mistakes, but we should judge his whole record. And in a lot of ways, that is where we go when a president dies. We have this longing, it seems like, to turn these figures, flawed as they may be, into something that speaks to our better angels. We want to hold our presidents up to the height that we hold for the presidency itself.
Yeah. I'm talking about Dead Presidents with Brady Carlson. He's NHPR's weekend host and author of a new book called Dead Presidents. Now we've seen this big shift from the imposing memorials to the presidential library. So what does that shift mean in presidential regard, both by the public and by the self?
Well, the presidential library system is the big shift in how we remember presidents. And that started when Franklin Roosevelt was president. He wanted an archive to hold all of his papers, his public documents, and all of his personal memorabilia. He was a collector of things, and he had a lot of stuff, and he wanted a place to put all of this stuff so that historians could go through it and so that the public could go through it, and partly so that people could remember his presidency in a positive way. And that has become the somewhat controversial but guiding principles of the presidential library system, is that the presidents have a lot of say in how they're at least initially put together and the kind of messages they put out there about those presidencies. They are making a pitch for how they should be remembered. And the federal government, through the National Archives and Records Administration, is paying for that. Just in the way that presidents get state funerals, we're paying for all of the grandeur and the missing man airplane formations as they are laid to rest, and the military bugler playing taps. That's all paid for as part of a state funeral. And the presidential libraries are in part paid for by us as well. So it's worth taking a look at what they are and what they mean.
But are they any less grandiose than, you know, a face on Mount Rushmore? I mean,
I never would have thought so until I realized how much square footage. I mean, they were talking about buildings that are hundreds of thousands of square feet. There are lots and lots of exhibits and lots of things like gifts that they've been giving by other heads of state and photo montages of what their lives and their careers were like. So in their own ways, they are just as big as putting something like the Lincoln Memorial or the Washington Monument together.
Grover Nordquist makes a big case. His crusade is something that you feature in your book. He wants to get Ronald Reagan Memorial in every single county in the United States. I think it's 3,000. You counted up something like that. But he does make the point that FDR, JFK, and he even mentions, I think, Martin Luther King Jr., these are all liberal Democrats who got memorials, big spenders in his mind, but not Ronald Reagan. Do you think that's a fair argument?
Well, I mean, it's certainly a big question, and I think a lot of the critics who will point to Grover Norquist and the Reagan Legacy Project, as it's called, as an example of, you know, partisanship gone too far, will maybe forget that these things are sometimes built for partisan purposes. I mean, it was during the New Deal that Roosevelt had the Jefferson Memorial built in Washington, D.C. And that was in part because he was trying to tie his policies, which some people found very new and controversial at the time, to the legacy of Thomas Jefferson. It's a stretch in a lot of ways, but the idea of looking out for the little guy, Jefferson did it and I'll do it too. And he put Jefferson on the nickel at that same time. So it's not a necessarily new thing for people of a particular partisan persuasion to use a legacy like Jefferson's or Reagan's as a way to push a particular partisan vehicle. You could make the argument that conservatives who are about restraining the size of government may have a harder time doing this because of that philosophical viewpoint. I mean, the great example of that is Calvin Coolidge, who had people who wanted to build large monuments in his honor and have a big monument at his gravesite, and he turned them down. He said, that's kind of not who I am. I'm a believer that government should be smaller, not larger. And so in that way, yes, it is different, I think, a bit for conservatives than it might be for progressives.
Well, obviously, a lot has changed over the years. But how about for you? What did writing this book reveal to you about how we, the American people, view our dead presidents? You know, was there a sort of takeaway?
Well, that's a question that goes back really to the days of George Washington. Who is the president? Is it a person who belongs to the nation and is a mythical, historical, larger-than-life figure? Or is it as a human being who happens to have a very important job? And the country has wrestled with this in a lot of different ways. In the early days, as we saw with George Washington, that idea that the country needs a great man to bind it together, we see more of that style of memorializing. We see this enormous monument in the center of a city named for George Washington. It was the largest structure in the world at the time, bigger than any of the cathedrals in Europe. And you see the faces of Washington and Lincoln and Jefferson and Teddy Roosevelt on Mount Rushmore. You see that idea that we need to have big people because we're a big nation and an important nation, and important nations must have important figures guiding them through history. That's something that over time starts to recede somewhat for a lot of different reasons. One is that mass media means that the presidents are there in front of us every day. They're not remote, distant figures who are shaping things from afar. They're a little easier to engage with, and they're also more flawed. The more we have learned about presidents over time is that they're humans. They have good and bad points like everybody else, and some of them do some really not so great things. And it's hard to put a face on a mountain that's 12 times life size when you know what that person is capable of, good or bad. One of my favorite places that I visited in this whole crazy trip was near Mount Rushmore. It was just down the road in Rapid City, South Dakota. They have life-size statues of all the presidents on the street corners in downtown Rapid City. And I thought, what a great contrast. Here we have the two views of the presidents and the presidency, the huge, mythical, larger-than-life figures on Mount Rushmore, and the regular old life-size ones just standing right next to us as we walk down the street. And there's really room in America for both, I find. You know, it's nice to be able to look up at a figure and use them as an example or as an argument settler or someone you could name a school after. And then it's nice to also know that they're human beings like the rest of us. And maybe if they can reach these great historical heights, then maybe there's something great in it for us, too.
Dead Presidents on a Human Scale from Brady Carlson. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Brady Carlson, he's an NHPR reporter and weekend host and author of the book Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Surprising Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. Now, Brady's going to be reading at several New Hampshire bookstores and bookstores in Cambridge, Massachusetts, New York City, and Washington, D.C., among other places. There's a full list of the events at wordofmouthradio.org. Before the break, we spoke with Brady Carlson about how we remember presidents after their deaths. Richard Nixon will forever be linked to his role in the Watergate scandal, but that's not the only part of his presidency that will end up in the history books. This next piece comes to us from Backstory with the American History Guys. Hosts Brian Ballow, Ed Ayers, and Peter Onuf looked into the exceptional events that led to President Nixon's historic state visit to China in 1972.
Just a year before, the idea of an American president setting foot in communist China would have been unthinkable. The two countries were bitter Cold War foes. But Chinese leader Mao Zedong and President Nixon separately realized that they had a common enemy in the Soviet Union. Because the U.S. didn't recognize the People's Republic of China, the leaders had no obvious way to communicate. Author Nicholas Griffin wrote a book about this quandary. He says Nixon's national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, began by approaching neutral countries.
And sure enough, a month later, a handwritten note arrives from China through the Pakistani ambassador and is delivered straight to Nixon and to Kissinger.
So he's like carrying a briefcase with this note and, you know, just takes it out and says, don't tell anybody about this, but
yeah,
I've got a note for you.
It's a handwritten note. It's not on any stationery. And, you know, you have to take the Pakistani ambassador's word that that's actually the hand of Zhou Enlai, the Chinese premier. But so that's how the Americans reply in a so similar manner, not on official stationery. These notes are traveling through Pakistani diplomatic baggage. You know, they don't get there for a couple of weeks. I mean, it's hard to imagine now, but this thing takes place very, very slowly and tentatively.
So was there one moment in all of this that you'd identify as a real breakthrough?
Well, there's sort of one moment where it sort of forced the breakthrough. They start doing this sort of slow motion dance of like, I'll do this and then we'll see what your signal is. Mm-hmm. And this was all going well back and forth until they made their move that we didn't catch. What Mao had done was he'd stuck an American journalist called Edgar Snow by his side during one of their great parades. And he thought that was a very obvious signal to America that things were rolling along nicely in this flirtation. But of course, Edgar Snow was a very left-wing journalist. And Mao had always presumed he must be secretly working for the CIA. But of course, to Kissinger and Nixon, he was this sort of raving lefty who they didn't trust at all.
Right, so they misread the signal.
Yeah, so we didn't think of that as their signal. So there we are waiting for their signal. They'd made it, and we didn't get it. And we sort of lapsed back into silence.
You know, Nick, this is beginning to sound like a lot of dances that I went to as a teenager.
You're probably right.
Okay, so signals sent, signals missed. What's the signal that is unmissable?
Well, I think that's the question the Chinese asked themselves. How can we come up with something so blindingly obvious?
For these dumb Americans.
For these dumb Americans that everyone's going to get it. And not just Kissinger and Nixon, but the entire of America is now going to get it. It's going to be that obvious. They decided to choose the sport of ping pong.
So how did they go about orchestrating that? Or did they orchestrate it? Was it just an accident?
What they had done was that there was going to be a world championships of table tennis in Japan. Now, of course, China didn't have diplomatic relations with Japan either. So they very quickly had to approach the Japanese sporting authorities and government and ask if they could be included as a last-minute team. And the idea was to have the Chinese table tennis team approach the American table tennis team, which was the strangest collection of this broad section of America. So it had everything from, you know, high school girls to a black immigrant from Guyana who worked in the United Nations to a hippie, Glenn Cowan. He you know, the guy was 19 years old, had sort of long brown hair and wore tie-dye bell-bottom trousers. It couldn't have been a greater difference between the two teams. You know, there was the Chinese team who were sort of basically lived in an enclosed sphere in Beijing, and all they did was play table tennis and study Mao's thoughts. And then here
this
come the
odd
Americans.
This mixture in the United States. Yeah. All right. So there they are in Japan now. It's what, 1970 now?
It's 1971.
1971. So what happens there in Japan?
Well, the Americans sort of going about their business of they're not a very good table tennis team, and they're losing you know, very quickly in the World Championships as the Chinese, who've now returned to the sport, are rolling on as they always did. And then there's a very odd incident where Glenn Cowan, the American hippie, misses the team bus, and he's sort of hanging back, and he comes out of a training session, and there's a bus waiting there. And the people on it wave him on. He goes on, and who is it? It's the Chinese team's bus. So there he is, the first American in 24 years to be dealing with a Chinese delegation.
And what an American to be dealing with.
Of them. All the Americans, yeah. It's a 19-year-old Californian hippie.
So what did he say? Far out?
Pretty much. He sort of made sort of revolutionary overtures, as one would, that, you know, there are people who believe in revolution in our country, too. This is California, early 1970s.
You bet. Right.
And, you know, who comes to greet him from the back of the bus but the greatest table tennis player of all time, a man called Chuang Sedung, who is very much working hand in hand, you know, with his sporting authority and the government. And he gives Cowan this elaborate present. Now, no one gave anyone presents. At a sporting level, you're only allowed to give tiny pins to one another. So the fact that he gave him this silk screen of mountains was...
Which he just happened to have on him.
So this is a moment that had been highly orchestrated by the Chinese to look spontaneous.
Right.
And sure enough, the American ping pong team was invited immediately to Beijing.
On the spot.
And they left Japan within 48 hours... and landed for this remarkable week that's known as ping pong diplomacy.
Good evening. The bamboo curtain has been cracked by a ping pong ball. For some time, there have been indications of a potential thaw in the more than two decades of...
And were the diplomats back in the United States a little worried about this? Were they concerned that this was some kind of setup?
They were very worried, but Kissinger and Nixon understood immediately that this obviously had nothing to do with ping pong and everything to do with geopolitics.
Uh-huh.
The big worry was, who are these people who are representing America? You know, there were some very odd moments. Cowan the hippie thought, well, surely if it's a communist country, I can pretty much use whatever I want. So he went out one morning at 4 and just stole a bicycle, thinking, you know, every bicycle is a bicycle, right? And suddenly
he was owned by the people.
Yeah, he was being sort of followed down the street by sort of a mob of Chinese. Cowan undoubtedly carried drugs into communist China, which was a mixture of marijuana and hallucinogens.
Interesting.
You know, it was a very bizarre time. But the number one thing was that the Chinese weren't going to let anything happen to the Americans. And the idea was to get through this week, because what the brilliance of using something cultural in a circumstance like that is it carried with it and or rather changed what the people of the respective countries thought of one another.
Right.
So if you look at opinion polls at the end of 1970, they're still very much against the Red Chinese. They basically hadn't budged. But suddenly, in the spring of 71, the Chinese are humanized through ping pong and their good treatment of the American team. And you suddenly get a majority of Americans who want to invite Red China into the United Nations.
And how does this lead to Nixon's famous trip to China in 1972?
It all happens very quickly. So you get the spring of 71 is when the ping pong team arrive. By July, you have Kissinger going on his secret mission to figure out if the Chinese would like to invite Nixon. And Nixon arrives in February the next year. So it's really 1, 2, 3. I think from a Chinese point of view, it's fantastic. If you think of any negotiation, the first thing you want to secure is home court advantage.
Yes.
The Chinese did that with the ping pong team. They did it with the arrival of Kissinger. And then they did it again when Nixon arrived.
Do you play ping pong?
I play a little. I'm not particularly good.
Is there anything about the game itself that you think lends itself to diplomacy? I understand now that there was this long history of the internationalization of the sport that allowed the Chinese to get involved. But what about the game itself? Do you think it's particularly conducive to diplomacy?
I think, I'll tell you what the experts will tell you, that it sets off the same part of the brain as chess does, which is your strategy and diplomacy. But the difference is, of course, that the ball's coming towards you at 70 miles an hour again and again and again. So, you know, you're thinking on your feet. The other big difference is, of course, how close you are to your opponent. It's remarkably close. So you can actually read, you know, human emotions on your opponent's face. So
absolutely. And that net can look awfully low, especially against a good opponent.
Especially after a beer or two, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Backstory.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nicholas Griffin is the author of Ping Pong Diplomacy, The Secret History Behind the Game That Changed the World.
Even after Richard Nixon resigned from office in 1974, he took several more trips to China to cement economic ties. We wanted to end the show today in the streets of Shanghai to hear from Chinese citizens who remember Nixon in his first historic visit.
We knew about it in the village. It was a big deal. Everyone in the country listened to the radio, the National People's Radio.
Back then, we were a closed society. We didn't know about foreigners. If we saw one, it was like seeing an exotic animal.
Nixon the person didn't leave much of an impression on Chinese, but his actions affected us greatly.
We thought Nixon was a great man for coming to China and allowing the U.S. and China to be able to communicate. I think he is one of America's greatest politicians.
He was like the first person who dared to eat a crab. He was so brave to come to China and build relations between the two countries. Chinese people won't forget this.
These were the voices of Qing Yi, Yao Jintao, and Wang Reisheng on the streets of Shanghai. Thanks to reporter and translator Rebecca Canther in Shanghai for that snapshot.
And that story came to us from Backstory with the American History Guys.
And when I wake up, I recognize you looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I be looking at you from the face down. One Mac 11, even room with the bass down. Skimming, and let me tell you about my life. Painkillers only put me in a twilight.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, if diversity of nominees is your yardstick, the Grammys look pretty good, at least compared to the Oscars. But that's not saying much, especially when considering the winners. Only 10 awards for Album of the Year have gone to black artists since the Grammys launched in 1959, and three of those to Stevie Wonder. This year, rapper Kendrick Lamar's 11 nominations could be a game changer. Tim Riley, Beatle author and Emerson journalism professor, is not holding his breath. Tim, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Virginia. Good to be here.
Well, first, a little on Kendrick Lamar's record, To Pimp a Butterfly. We were just listening to the track All Right from there. What makes it such a standout?
Well, a lot of things. First of all, a lot of people talk about how many jazz musicians are on this record. He's clearly reaching further to cross styles than a lot of other rap records. It's very ambitious. It's intensely creative. He's trying to argue for rap as a style that needs to take its place as one of the preeminent musical styles of the new century. You know, it's time that we start giving rap the same respect that we give jazz and rock and roll.
In front of a dirty double mirror, they tell me, and I love myself. Oh, I want you looking at me. Tell me, what do you see? I love myself. I put a bullet in the back of the back of the head and the bullet. I love myself. Oh, illuminated by the hand of God. Boy, don't seem shy. I love myself. One day at a time. They wanna say it's a war outside. Bomb in the street, gun in the hood, mob of police, whack on the corner with a line full of fiend and a bottle full of lean and a mother wanna scheme.
For his part, Kendrick Lamar told Billboard of the 11 nominations, I want to win them all. What is he up against?
Right. He's up against a lot of the usual suspects, but a lot of younger people are in that category. And so that's one way in which the nominations really have done better with the nominating process this year. They're skewing younger and they're skewing more to women.
Well, what's the record of rap at the Grammys and Kendrick Lamar's record for that matter?
Well, so Lamar is famously snubbed in 2014 when Macklemore wins, I forget how many awards, but Macklemore famously texts Kendrick Lamar after that award show and says, you was robbed. I feel funny winning it. You had the better record. Even before Macklemore won in 2014, the only previous rap albums of the year that have won that Grammy Album of the Year include Lauryn Hill, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, back in 1999, and then Outkast with Speakerbox in 2004. So there's a lot of expectations surrounding Kendrick Lamar this year because it really is a very intense and core rap experience. With, you know, we heard the N-word in that song. There's a lots of other words that we couldn't put out on the air. And so is the white establishment music industry going to sanction this record, which really is a black protest record, what they would have called 40 years ago a black power record? And if they do sanction it, it is going to signal a turning point. If they don't give it a major award, that's going to be a victory of a different kind for him. It's going to be proof positive that the industry really does not want to sanction this kind of style. And I can't recommend the album enough. I mean, it's one of the few rap albums — I'm a rock history guy — but it's one of the very few rap albums that has won me over completely. I listen to it obsessively, and every time I hear it, I hear new things on it.
In addition to Kendrick Lamar's nomination, in the traditionally male-dominated field of rock, there are more women or female-fronted bands nominated in the Best Rock Performance category, and 4 of the 5 nominees for Best Rock Song. Here's one of them, X's and O's from L. King.
But they never want to leave.
That's L. King singing X's and O's, one of the songs nominated for Best Rock Performance. Tim, what does this mean? So many women nominated in this very male category.
Well, so it means that we're finally catching up. Nobody looks to the Grammys to sort of set the pace, but you do have to say by 2016, the fact that both Alabama Shakes and Florence of Florence and the Machine have 4 nominations each, that's a much more respectable showing for women than in previous years. Now, is it late? Yeah, it's really late. But it's good to see it happening at all. And, you know, Alabama Shakes, one of my favorite young bands, they're going to be, you know, they should walk away with a couple Grammys this year, and that can only be good, right?
Well, doesn't Foo Fighters always win this category?
Yes, I mean, but, you know, Foo Fighters, they're the new Phil Collins. I mean, so the other thing about the Grammys is that they tend to replicate and mirror the problems of the larger capitalist system at large, which is they over-reward the leaders, and they under-reward the people on the fringes or the people on the way up. So, you know, you'll see people like Stevie Wonder for years would walk away with, you know, just an armful of awards. Well, it's fine. He's very deserving. Nobody's saying he shouldn't get awards, but why do you pile it on one person, right? And the Grammys have always had that problem, much more so than almost any other award show. You see people walk away with 5, 6, 7 Grammys. There's clearly this kind of inertia that builds up with people's excitement about certain artists.
The Grammy Awards are on tonight, and Tim Riley is with us to talk about some of this year's nominees, some of which he thinks signal big changes for the recording industry, and depending on who wins, could be game changers for America's music scene. Well, Tim, Tony Bennett is one of those people that seem to sail away with the Best Traditional Pop Album Award year after year. This year, Bob Dylan is in the running. Is he new to this category?
Well, yeah, he is. And he's recorded a really interesting, weird record. Of course, that weird is just par for Bob Dylan, but he's recorded a Frank Sinatra tribute album called Shadows in the Night. So he's up against Tony Bennett. So who do you root for there, Bob Dylan or Tony Bennett? And it's very odd because it's not a, I mean, I'm a big Dylan guy, but late Dylan is not really my cup of tea. But it's a record that really is quite intriguing just because you hear the love that Dylan has for those great old songs and that great old crooning style. He's not quite up to it. And in fact, if you shouldn't turn to that record if you want a good old-fashioned crooning record. But it's fascinating nonetheless because Dylan's making some very, very interesting connections between that crooning style and that songwriting style and the rock and roll style that he's better known for.
Well, let's hear a little bit from that record, I'm a Fool to Want You, the opener to the new Bob Dylan record.
I'm a fool to want you. I'm a fool to want you. To want a love
that's there for others too. I'm a fool to hold you.
So, Tim, what didn't make it, as far as you're concerned, for this year's Grammy nominations?
So there's a couple interesting omissions. I'm a big fan of that Brian Wilson movie, Love and Mercy, where Paul Dano plays the young Brian Wilson. And he did all his own singing in that movie, which I thought
no
was rather astounding. And he even sings Surf's Up, which is a real virtuoso piece for voice. And I was really surprised that he didn't get a nod there. The other thing was that the 50 Shades of Grey soundtrack for, you know, I don't know what you want to call a movie, a junky movie, a trashy movie. But the soundtrack, if you're interested at all in crossing over into classical music, has a really interesting selection of classical artists, including one of my favorite Italian pianists, Maria Tipo. And you just rarely ever hear her. And it was so refreshing to see a soundtrack record with classical selections, and they could have chosen anybody. But they chose the pianist, Maria Tipo, and the idea that she's getting exposed through that vehicle is just really wonderful.
Well, let's hear a little bit of pianist Maria Tipo. This is from the classical 50 Shades of Grey soundtrack. Well, Tim, I have to admit, I think I knew two of the new artists who were nominated for new artists this year. I mean, I was an RIA member for years. I used to vote, and because I used to write liner notes, and I'm embarrassed that I'm part of the problem. I mean, aren't we?
Yes, I think we are, and there's clearly a new generation gap coming up. And you know, think of it as like Snapchat. I mean, for all of the people who use Snapchat, they're in their own world. They got their own language. They got their own favorite tunes and everything. And those of us who aren't using Snapchat really just don't get it. So I think there's a lot of that going on. And social media is a big demarcator of that. And the pop music is also another indicator. And I think that that's to the Grammys' credit that they actually are puzzling old fogies like us, I guess.
Tim Riley, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Tim Riley, he's Emerson journalism professor and author of several books about music, most recently Lennon, Man, Myth, and Music. More at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for listening today. Whether you're listening to us from the driver's seat of a brand new car or celebrating in more somber fashion, we wish you a very happy President's Day. And there's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And don't forget, you can listen to Word of Mouth anytime, the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you'd like the podcast, please share it with a friend or rate it on iTunes. That'll help other people to find it. And as we know, the best stuff gets shared via word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio. You're always worth it.